Let's do this. The Cult of Hockey podcast by the faithful and for the faithful. I'm David Staples of the Edmonton Journal, and I'm here today with Bruce McCurdy. Hey, Bruce.
Hey, David. How are you doing today?
Excellent. Beautiful day. Well, it's kind of overcast, but I'm still hoping to get out there and do a little exercise. Early morning game for us. Noontime game for the Oilers. They lose 3-2 in overtime to the Buffalo Sabres. Shootout.
Also, they also lost overtime.
Yes. they tried to. They deserve to. Bruce, so as usual, we recorded grade A shots in the game. And the grade A shots were, in total, for the whole game, 14-11 for the Sabres in this game, including the Sabres. If you go for the third period in overtime, the Oilers did not have one grade A shot in the third period or overtime. So we could clearly see which was the team that wanted to win this game. The Buffalo Sabres had 7-0 in the third period in overtime. Wasn't great. So this is our two good things, two bad things, two numbers podcast with one conundrum. And in the conundrum, I'll just tell you what it is. Did the Oilers do enough in at the trade deadline as compared to their competition? So we'll probably spend quite a bit of time actually focusing on that and a little less time on a rather mundane and disappointing hockey game. I'll start it off, Bruce, with my good thing, because it was the first thing. It was the decision by the coach, Coach K. People don't like it when I call him Coach K because they think that's sacrosanct. There's only can be only one Coach K. But I like it as a shorthand anyway, especially when it's on my own Twitter and I'm trying to save characters. So Chris Knobloch decided to go with McDavid, Fogel, and Ryan McLeod. And I think if I recall correctly, when they were together earlier this year, their goals for against was 10 goals for, 3 against at 5-on-5, which is one of the best numbers you'll see on the team. They weren't together for a long time. And I was speculating on why they split up. And you mentioned it, and someone else also told me this. It's because Ryan was really struggling at third line center. Their third line was struggling at the time. I think it was Kane, Ryan, and Janmark, people were saying. I don't recall specifically. Anyway, their third line was apparently struggling. So that's why they decided they needed to break up that line. It was more trying to balance things out. So I understand that. The coach is always juggling. But that was a really, really good line, Bruce. And I think it's a good line for one reason. I think Leon Draisaitl works best with hockey players who are fast. Because hockey players who are fast create space for Leon Draisaitl. And he can hit them with passes, but if he's crowded, if they're all over Draisaitl, if it's you know, they're all closed in and there's not people creating space for him, it's tougher for him. So with their speed, he gets time. He gets time and space to make plays, and you don't want to give Leon Draisaitl time and space to make time. He doesn't need much. And I think this is just a really, really, really good idea for a line. And we've been talking for some time about, well, maybe the Oilers should have McDavid and Draisaitl, and that's, I can see the wisdom of that. But in a close game, at the end of the game, if you're down by a goal, let's say 10 minutes left in the third period, it seems like if the Oilers then put out the McDavid Draisaitl line, that's it. You know, they will then struggle for the next 3 minutes as the other lines are on the ice, so the next 2 minutes as the other lines are on the ice, and then McDavid and Draisaitl will go out and they'll overstay their time on the ice. They'll get too tired. There's a tendency for that to happen. But if you have two, and it again reinforced this idea, you need to win the Stanley Cup this year, Bruce, you're going to need two scoring lines. So if they can get that without McDavid and Draisaitl on the same line, that's fantastic. And it's possible they'll find a combination, a second line without McDavid or Draisaitl on it, that will work. But the Hyman, Nugent, Hopkins, McDavid line should work as a scoring line. It didn't work today at all. But if they can get a second line around Draisaitl, with a couple wingers. And I think this is the best bet. I really do. And tonight, right off the hop, it clicked. McLeod was sent in on a two on a rush, and he just missed the net, almost scored. Puck
8 seconds in.
Yeah, puck came, I don't know if it came out of the zone. Anyway, they were working it around the zone again, and it was a really nice play. Dreisaitl kept it in at the blue line, went over to Darnell Nurse, who puck protected for a second, put it over to Fogel, and Fogel immediately then passed it into the slot. And Dreisaitl then immediately made an incredible backhand pass to McLeod at the side of that, who immediately fired on net and slammed it in. That was as pretty a goal as you're going to see in terms of one-touch passing and shooting. There was 2 one-touch passes combined with a one-touch shot. And, I like this decision. I think they should stick with this line for a while to see if they can make, if this line has, can make it work, because I think it's going to be their best option for what they're going to need in the playoffs. For a second.
Well, they certainly have more options now. Like McLeod is not necessarily the check down to 3C anymore like he was before. Like anytime he was on the second line, you know, I mean, they were going with, for a while there, they had Ryan playing 3C, and they had Holloway playing 4C. Mm-hmm. And neither line could score, and they, you know, they weren't particularly strong, I didn't think. So the new alignment where Henrique at least solves, you could put, I think, a number of different choices on the wing and be okay on your third line.
Yeah.
But it frees them to use McLeod up the lineup if they care to, and he marked that occasion today by scoring his, wait for it, 4th goal of the year in the first minute of play in a game. Which, when you consider how many games he never saw the ice in the first minute because he's in the third line, it's almost unbelievable that he's got 4 first minute goals in various games this year. One against Carolina, one when they first put this line together at Madison Square Garden, he scored 30 seconds of the first period. This game, he scored 29 seconds of the first period when they reunited the line. That's a pretty nice way to start a game with a 1-0 lead. And for that brief few moments there, I felt confident that Edmonton was going to shake off the crap game they played in Columbus.
Yes.
With a stronger effort and put it to bed.
So Bruce Fogel, his points per 60 for the last two seasons is 2.2. Mm-hmm. The average, the top 180 forwards in the NHL, so that's those are the first top and second line forwards, yep. For each team. It's actually a higher number than that now that I think of it. But anyway, yeah, 192. Both, I think McLeod also makes it. He's at 1.72 per 60 heading into this game, and they both got an even strength point tonight. So these guys are, by scoring, and McLeod has done this, Bruce, even though he's rarely played in the top six, even though he's mostly played as on the third or fourth lines in that time period. So I think they've richly, you know, they got to earn it. They got to earn it. You know, people say Ryan McLeod has earned it. He has earned a real shot at the top six, and Fogel definitely has. And Bruce, again, I was struck by how many people yesterday were complaining about Fogel. Second
line winger.
We need a second line winger. Like, and these are people who, a lot of them were people who claim they put a lot of store in analytics, you know. And I'm just wondering, why aren't they looking at the most important analytic, which is, especially on the Oilers, if you're not going to play the power play, even strength points at 5-on-5 over an extended time period. Warren Fogel has been close. He's been a top line winger, Bruce. He's at 58th overall in the NHL in points per 60, even strength. And some people are saying, well, you know, they just write him off. I don't get it at all. Why the hate for Warren Fogel? It's not really hate, but you know, is it people are mad? They don't want to give Ken Holland credit for a good trade. Are people mad that, you know, still over the Ethan Bedford-Fogle trade? Is that it? Are they stuck in their first impression of Fogle, where he did struggle in his first season? He wasn't a really good player. He didn't earn his contract in his first year. It's only halfway through his second year here that he took off. But since then, he has taken off. So I'm mystified by the lack of respect for Warren Fogle from a huge part of the fan base.
Yeah, it's more that. Like, he keeps producing results, and anytime he gets pushed up to the top six, he contributes offensively. Like, he's been good with Leon for each of the last 2 years. I'm not sure, it's not even each of the last 3 years. I'd have to go back, but he makes stuff happen, and he's getting increasingly confident and, you know, making good plays. It's not just, you know, hard drive to the net and try and pound one in, but he's made some, you know, good passes and some, you know, decent offensive maneuvers. Like, he's clearly gaining in confidence throughout his time in Edmonton, and he's reached another level this year, and I'm not uncomfortable to see him in the top six.
Here's one final statistic is in my ranting. It's not only the fan base, like, it's taken the coaches on the Oilers, I think, some time to recognize Fogle's value to the team, especially in relation to comparison to Evander Kane. So Evander Kane's at even strength has played 15 minutes a game the last 2 years, and Fogle's played 12 minutes a game the last 2 years. This, despite the fact that Fogle is a superior defensive player to Kane in terms of suppressing grade A shots and not making mistakes on grade A shots. And he also outscored him. Fogle's also outscored him 2.2 points per 60, whereas Kane is at 1.8 points per 60. So that's a significant. Kane's still doing well, but he's also played with McDavid and Draisaitl a lot more than Fogle in that time period. So anyway, I like to see Fogle in the top six. He's earned it. McLeod has earned it. They should stick with it. It's a good idea. And I appreciate Coach K going in that direction today. What's your good thing?
Yeah, well, basically it is McLeod and Fogle and Draisaitl as a line playing a 700th NHL game. But McLeod and Fogle, who with a great play between the two of them made the score 2-0 for Edmonton midway in the first on the penalty kill. And it all started because Fogle pressured the guy right when he was coming to the Edmonton blue line and chipped the puck off his stick. And then the Buffalo guy tried to reverse the puck, and it wound up going into the neutral zone where the two speedsters, McLeod and Fogle, jumped on the puck and separated. So it basically turned it into a 2-on-0, and they played a little hot potato with it, McLeod to Fogle to McLeod back to Fogle, and he slammed it into the back of the net. Very nice execution on a 2-on-0, and they actually shot it on net, which is also a real good thing to do on an odd man rush. And do I sound bitter? I feel pretty bitter today. I do not like this game for the most part, but I love that goal, and I love the play that those two guys made to, first of all, create the opportunity by defending their blue line and then jumping on it and executing it to perfection.
Yeah. And if they had not scored, of course, everyone would have been saying, hey, they passed it too much, because that's what everybody says when there's extra passes on a rush like that. But the passes were all sound. These are NHL players. They should be able to make these passes. And they did, and they executed it, and they scored. And this is, again, Fogle. He's ahead of Kane. Like, he's earned a spot on the PK. Concerning his, you know, I don't know how great a PKer that Fogle is, honestly. I can't say. I haven't really dug into our numbers even this year, and it's the hardest thing actually to assess is the value of players on the PK by numbers, because it's such a difficult thing to assess who makes mistakes, and it's also a difficult thing, I think, even if you just go by overall shot and goal rates against on the PK with players out there, that's also just can be really misleading. So anyway, Bruce, are bad things? I'll step up first. The Buffalo second goal was an abomination. It was an abomination. The Oilers had actually been playing pretty well up until then. They were starting to lose it in the third period, though. They were starting to back off. And this was just such a display of passive, half-assed defending. And it was with some of their best line was on the ice. Some of their best players were on the ice when this happened. And it starts with the zone entry where, you know, Buffalo takes it in and just two stick checks by Hyman and Nugent Hopkins at the blue line and kind of half-hearted stick checks, frankly. But then it gets worse because they take it in. And even though there's been this zone entry that was where there has been lackluster, half-hearted defense, Vinny Deharnais makes a really nice play. He steps up, puts it off the Buffalo attacker's stick, and Connor McDavid gets it. And great. Connor McDavid has the puck on his stick. And what does he do? He just makes a lazy clearance, a lazy turnover. You know, he doesn't charge up the ice. He doesn't, like, with great energy, suddenly attack up the ice or fire it out then. If you're not going to do that, get it out. You know, in the what do they say in the third period when you have a lead? Just hard plays out of your own zone with the puck. So even if you miss with the pass, it gets out. And he just made a lazy turnover. And they scooped it up. And still it wasn't terrible because it goes on the stick. What's his name? Bryson. I think it's Jacob Bryson. He hardly ever scores. It's not Bill Bryson, the author.
Jacob Bryson, yeah. It was his first goal in 68 games.
So his first goal, in, as
like
Bruce
Cody
says,
Ceci scoring.
First goal in 68 years in the NHL. He's not much of a scorer. He gets the puck, and when he gets it, at the moment that he gets it, Bruce, after McDavid's turnover, Nugent Hopkins is even with him. Mm-hmm. And if Ryan Nugent Hopkins moves his feet, he will stop anything from happening. But Ryan Nugent Hopkins doesn't. He passively holds back, waits. And you know, they're not in a zone yet, really. Like, I understand if you're in a zone, you're a little bit passive, but this wasn't really a zone moment. And if he could have easily matched that guy's speed and stopped this lame backhand shot that goes in on net if Nugent Hopkins had moved his stick and got stick on puck. And then finally, as happens so often at the end of a horrible sequence of pain, there's a shot and Darnell Nurse is, poor Darnell, screening the goalie. So I don't think Stuart Skinner saw that shot until it was by him or just at the last second he would have seen it. So and again, you know, Nurse was a little passive too. I think he might have been even able to get out there and block that. If all of them been on their toes and been aggressive, or even if one of them had, there's no goal. But it's just one passive.
200 feet away if they'd been paying attention.
Yeah, it was really weak defending, and it ends up in a tie game. They gave away a point.
I'll add weak goaltending because. That shot should not go in. Like he lobs a backhand at the middle of the net and it hits Skinner, who's falling forward for reasons that escape me entirely. And it kind of hits him in the side and bounces into the top corner. Like he's nowhere near the angle, you know, just stand up, face the shooter. I mean, stay square to the shooter and that never goes in. And he was just nowhere close to the shooter. So I would say missed assignment on the goalie, even as the team in front of him messed up a few times. Skinner got better after that and made a couple of emergency saves to keep Oilers in the game. But I didn't think he had a shiny game as Post did.
Four posts. Yeah, he was looking. So there was a screen by Nurse and maybe a Sabres player too. And Skinner was looking on the wrong side of him. There was also a Sabres player right to his left who he was thinking might get the pass. So he was shading over there. So I think when the puck does get through, the reason he's on his toes is he's leaning the wrong direction and he probably shouldn't have been, leaning at all. And maybe if that was the case, he would have made the save. So I think you're right, Bruce, that there was a goalie error on that as well. Compounding everything. What's your bad thing?
Yeah, I'm going to single out Connor McDavid. I thought that this was one of the poorest games that he's played in 8 years. Really, really poor game by him. And it just kept getting worse. Like he was struggling to control the puck. On the Edmonton's power play, which was 0-for-3 and never came even close, really, to scoring. As Leon had one that he tried to bounce in off the goalie's head. That was their best chance. And it just kept, it would go to McDavid, and he would fumble it, or he would, his pass wouldn't get through and they'd shoot the puck out. And he was clearly frustrated, and his frustration just grew and grew as the game went on. He did have one good shot off the post, which actually puts him in the league lead for most posts, 13 on the season. So pretty high number for a guy that's got, you know, a relatively low number of goals. But after he made that weak turnover on the 2-2 goal, that was his first defensive error of the game. Well, Buffalo had the last, as you said earlier, last seven grade A shots in the final two frames. And there was one more in the third period on a turnover by McDavid for a five alarm shot with 6 minutes left. And then in overtime, there was three grade A shots, all by Buffalo and all involving mistakes by Connor McDavid, Edmonton's captain, who coach kept throwing over the boards, and he kept playing. I mean, I understand why you do that, but there was a he allowed a shot on his first shift. On the second one, he lost a battle, and Bouchard allowed the shot. And then after the game miraculously continued, Buffalo scored the apparent game winner with 2 seconds left, only for it to be overturned minutes later on a microscopic offside call at the blue line. So they got another 20-second shift, and they put out the top guys again. And McDavid, this time, after he got I'm not sure hauled down is the word, but he lost the puck battle in the offensive zone. And Buffalo had one chance. The puck went into the corner, and there's no time even to take it up, and he just lobs it up the boards to nobody, and it winds up going in front for like a grade A++ chance with two. Buffalo almost won it for the second time with 2 seconds left in overtime. Just completely sloppy play, and unfortunately, on this day, the captain was as sloppy as anyone on the team. He just did not have it in this game, and it was painful to watch, David. It was 5 consecutive grade A chances with an error against. You wouldn't expect that on any player on the team, defenseman or forward, and certainly not transcendent superstar. But here we are.
Indeed, here we are. It was a really. And then he didn't score in the shootout.
And then a weak attempt on the shootout where he just never opened any daylight at all on the goalie, and he just didn't seem to have his.
He's fighting it. He knows it. He went for extra practice, so he'll come.
Yeah, on. And didn't seem to help a whole lot.
Yeah, he'll come. Yeah, it was just a terrible defensive effort, and atypical for him. Mm-hmm. He's been a solid defensive player this year, and that's not what we usually see. But yeah, he started to get a little bit antsy or something and make mistakes. The first mistake was actually a tough one, the first one was the goal against that was on him. But the second one, which led to a really good chance, I can't remember who took it in the third period with 6 minutes left, but the puck took a bad hop over his stick, which is why he missed it. It was it was a rebound shot. It hit into the corner and bounced out, and it just bounced over his stick. So that was a tough.
All right. It looked like he had it, and then it was.
Yeah, that was that was a tough bounce, and then suddenly, boom, it's a shot right in front of them, a really dangerous shot. But still, his job is to corral the puck, and he wasn't able to do it. So, Bruce, go ahead.
He wasn't alone, David. There was a whole lot of the Oilers, in general, handled the puck like it was a live grenade throughout this game.
Yes.
On the radio, they were saying they got worse in the third period. I thought the second period was just mine. Like, Buffalo kept missing the net on clean chances, or it would have been, you know, there was no way that this game should have been 2-2.
Well, but that gets to directly to my number.
Go for it.
We'll just go there. We'll do our numbers now. And you're right, Bruce. So Buffalo had, 14 grade A shots. Mm-hmm. Well, there was 6 moments where they had 5 alarm opportunities, the highest level of danger, and they missed the net. Mm-hmm. So I'll go through them, and I think this is in order. It starts off with Alex Tuck moving in and deking Skinner, and all he's got to do is finish it, and he's unable to do so. And you know, to give Skinner credit,
got a piece of it or him along the way.
Yeah, Skinner might have upset him a little, so he misses that. Then massive Tage Thompson, who's such a fantastic hockey player, he was writing alone, and he fired it right over the net. So that was fantastic, because I thought that was going in for sure. Then there's
somebody coughed it right up to him too. I can't remember who it was. It's in my notes, but it was a direct turnover to Tage Thompson.
Ever a good idea. Then he then there's a Oilers power play, and the Sabres get a 3-on-1 rush, and Tuck, the Oilers made the play in the slot, but the puck bounced right to Alexander Tuck, and he fires it point blank and misses the net, fortunately. Then it bounces out to Dylan Cousins at the side of the net, and he's got a wide open net too, but he can't get a handle on it, and he misses the net. Then in the second period, there's a 2-on-1. And Tyson Yost has a fantastic opportunity to score on a 2-on-1. It's one of those where it's like a really, not all 2-on-1s are created equally. Sometimes you'll get like a 20% shot, and sometimes you'll get a 40% shot. Well, this was probably a 35% shot where he just missed the net and an open net on the 2-on-1. Then in the third, Bowen Byram makes a beautiful toe drag. He's wide open in the slot and he misses the net. So six opportunities and Buffalo missed the net. Now in the end, Bruce, it kind of got a little bit even, although the Oilers just hit one post and Buffalo hit four.
Now, we count Oilers, some of the posts. If they are grade A shots, we count them as shots.
That's right. We count them as shots. But the Oilers also had four opportunities where they had great chances. And first there was McLeod's in the first 8 seconds. He missed the net on that shot. Later in the game, Draisaitl is on a 3-on-1 and he misses Bouchard. Then McDavid gets a breakaway chance. And he, when Deacon, the goalie, he hit the side of the net. And finally in overtime, McDavid had Draisaitl wide open on a 2-on-1 break-in chance, and McDavid missed the pass to Draisaitl. So the Oilers kind of evened up the gas.
Did you have the one in there where Draisaitl and Brown and Bouchard broke out 3-on-1? And
that's where
Draisaitl missed Bouchard by 3 feet?
He did. He did indeed, Bruce. Yeah, and I included that. So okay, it was a game of missed opportunities. You were thinking of your next comment.
I'll add one more then, David. And this one didn't count because the play officially ended earlier. This is the overtime winner that wasn't by Buffalo, where Darnell Nurse got the puck in the corner and the guy came in, just stripped it right off of him, walked in on a breakaway and whiffed his chance with 8 seconds left.
That was Alexander.
And then they
Tuck.
Passed it back to the point to Owen Power, who basically just walked in, picked his shot, and nobody even challenged him, and he scored. But that was overturned. But the Tuck missed what looked like a game ender just before that. Buffalo's execution around the net was poor, or this would have been a real ugly number on the goals against side of the ledger.
It would have been. Yeah, I didn't include the Tuck one because, again, like it didn't
count.
Officially count. But right. It was, everyone was playing serious hockey then, and Nurse did get stripped of the puck, and Tuck blew it. What's your number, Bruce? Nurse.
Yeah, I'm going to skate right by the remarkable 39-10 advantage Edmonton enjoyed in the faceoff circle and zero in instead on the hit statistic, which Edmonton had 14 and Buffalo had 40. Now, some of that might be home stats counter, but to me, this was a game where Buffalo did play a hard physical game, and I'm not sure the Oilers did enough to answer the bell. I don't think Edmonton paid the price in this game to win battles, to win pucks, and to, you know, and actually retain pucks. And they got to, I mean, this is three games on the road trip with two goals in each game. And the Boston game was okay, but these last two games have been horrific. And they, you know, because they haven't invested in either game. The team deserved to lose both. I take the 1 point from today, but they, you know, they have teams with nothing to play for that are getting up for them, and they just basically didn't get up for either game, or at least not for long. Today, maybe the first 10 minutes, and then it just was a morass of mistakes thereafter. And very unsatisfying. Like, these are teams that the Oilers should be able to score on. And
Indeed. Bruce, let's move on to our conundrum. And the question of the day is did Ken Holland do enough in comparison to the opposition on deadline day? And of course, everybody, many people, many of us have lost their minds a little bit over Vegas's tactics / shenanigans at the deadline. I find it funny how many NHL reporters like insist that it, for sure, like the Vegas did nothing wrong because they know for sure that what's his noodle, Stone is badly injured. I guess they must be looking at Stone's private medical records to know that thing factually for sure. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I don't trust anything about Las Vegas's approach. That said, I don't see any reason to trust them. I don't know if the NHL has a credible method of checking whether players are truly injured or not either. I think probably the Stone, it seems to me probably the Stone thing is for real and serious, but the Martinez one, he was playing. I think he's been playing. I'll just check this.
Is he on LTIR? I'm not sure they ever put
him there. Oh, did they not put him there?
Maybe not sure. There was talk that they might.
I read that he had, but maybe he never did.
Let's see what they say on a cap friendly for long-term injured reserve, Stone, Leonard, and William Carrier that they just added.
Martinez was placed on injured reserve Wednesday.
Injured reserve, yes. Not long-term.
Oh, injured reserve. My bad then. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So they had enough room there. Well, we'll see. Maybe Stone really, I'm not going to say anything more. I've said enough. So what do you think of it, Bruce?
Well, Vegas issued the most unsurprising team announcement possible yesterday when they said that Stone has been ruled out for the rest of the regular season, but they don't know when he might be back thereafter.
Indeed.
Yeah, because they have, now they literally can't bring him back before the end of the season because they would have to, formally break the salary cap rules rather than merely circumvent them.
Oh,
so
here's,
he won't be back. But I have to take face value, lacerated spleen. But if he does come back at the beginning of the playoffs, there's going to be a whole lot of howling going on.
The NHL needs to publicly say how they check this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it needs to be a very open, transparent process, I think, at this point for people to have faith in what has just happened here. And has happened a few years. Is it 3 years in a row with Stone and Eichel between them? And it's just, they need to, maybe I've missed that, but I'm not aware of this process being open or transparent. It just seems to be self-regulation, which is never a good idea. So Bruce, here's what some of the hockey comments, I just did a post on the winners and losers of the trade deadline. And I looked at, probably about a dozen stories and podcasts on this topic. And every single one mentioned Vegas as a winner at the trade deadline. It was much more in the middle with the Oilers. And we'll get into what was said about the Oilers in a second. But here's what some people said about Vegas. This is TSN's Jeff O'Neill. I don't know what kind of calculator they have out there, but it's some kind of different variation of what everyone else is using. But this is why what we're here to see, somebody aggressively acquire talent. So I think that's true. People, there was general admiration in the hockey, from most hockey commentators on what Vegas did, pushing the rules to their limit. Here's Joe Yerden of Bleacher Report. Vegas Golden Knights general manager Kelly McCrimmon and owner Bill Foley have never met a transaction they couldn't make and a salary cap they couldn't make a little even fuzzier. What else could you expect from a team based in Vegas? It's all about entertainment. Here we have, it's his first name. It's not Dylan Larkin. He writes for the Daily Faceoff, Matt Larkin. Matt Larkin of the Daily Faceoff says, No team plays a better villain than the defending Stanley Cup champion Golden Knights. It's easy to accuse them of cheating when Captain Mark Stone seemingly lands on LTIR at the perfect time each year, but A lacerated spleen seems difficult to fake, and B, the Golden Knights are one of the 16 teams operating in LTIR. If you're a fan of another team lamenting Vegas's skullduggery, that's your jealousy talking. You wish your team was this aggressive. That comment is right on the right on the money. And finally, Nick Goss of NBC News. Does the salary cap apply to the Vegas Golden Knights? Kidding, but in all seriousness, if a team isn't finding every legal edge it can in a hard salary cap league, then management isn't doing its job. So what do you think of the general take there, Bruce?
Well, let's put it this way. If you ask me, would I like to circumvent the salary cap or find ways to add players to the roster by having the captain on LTIR with a lacerated spleen, I'll say no, I don't want that. And so Edmonton, you know, for better or worse, they don't have serious injuries, and you can't just create long-term injured reserve space without people being hurt. That's mostly good news, people, that the Oilers have been healthy and strong. Vegas, for whatever reason, Mark Stone seems to have a date with a doctor on Valentine's Day every year, and then he's declared ineligible for the, you know. And 2 years ago, it hurt Vegas in the sense that they didn't make the playoffs, and they missed Mark Stone. And the one thing I can't remember for sure is when in there they actually acquired Jack Eichel, you know, 2 years ago, the year they made the playoffs.
Well, they put Stone on LTIRI.
And then put him on
LTIR for a while, I think, is how it worked.
I think that's how they got him in there in the first place. So it did still kind of work out for him. And then last year, well, say no more. And this year, it's just too soon to comment on. It's just like saying, who won the trade deadline? Ask me in June. And I'll have a lot better answer than I do today, because it's just, you know, right now it's just a what if scenario, and all the who won the deadline questions are answering.
Here's a little bit of context at the trade deadline. This is the 5-on-5 scoring rates for all of the players that were acquired. And this is a really key stat for all of them, because very few of these guys will be playing on the power play of the teams they went to. Like, even the very top guys acquired, like Casey Mittelstadt, he might be on the top power play in Colorado, but I don't know if he will. Toffoli might in Winnipeg. Maybe. Elias Lindholm might in Vancouver now and then. Hurdle might as a net front guy. Monahan, maybe. But most of these guys are going to be proving their value and earning their money at even strength. So here's 5-on-5 scoring. Casey Mittelstadt, points per 60, the last 2 years, 2.25. Tyler Toffoli, 2.16. Adam Henrik, next, 1.88. Anthony Mantha, 1.85. Elias Lindholm, 1.83. Sean Monahan, 1.72. Thomas Hertl, 1.56. And I've included Corey Perry, I'm including him in there. He was a recent pickup, 1.23. Yakov Trenin, the fourth liner picked up by Colorado, 1.01. Brandon Duhaime, a fourth line winger picked up by Colorado, 0.94. And Sam Carrick, 0.69. He's one of the lowest players in the NHL. He's down there with Connor Brown. So Adam Henrique's scoring really compares well. And he's a center who looks, and good first impression about Adam Henrique's defense tonight, Bruce. It wasn't perfect, but I just thought he's really quick on his feet, and he's got a quick mind and a quick stick.
Good position, I thought.
I thought he was really solid positionally defensive as a center. He took that responsibility seriously. He wasn't creeping up in the play and charging off and on the attack ahead of time. So again, a first impression, but I liked what I saw. So in that regard, I think that the Oilers deal, what they gave up to get Henrik and Carrick, and also half retention on both, was the first round pick. That makes sense. You know, Mantha was a second round pick. Toffoli was a second round pick, but they're both wingers. They're not playing that key position of center. There was many more wingers available on the market. And so a late first round pick or a second round pick, there's not a whole heck of a lot of difference.
32nd overall, David.
Exactly, Bruce. In value between these picks, there really isn't. There's some difference in value between picking, let's say, 25th and 45th, but not a whole heck of a lot. And I think the deal that the Oilers did make, that deal was really good. And I really like the pickup of Troy Stetcher.
Me too.
I think if Cody Ceci struggles any more than he is already, he actually came on in this game and started to play pretty well as it went along. But I think they should get Stetcher in some games and start Ceci now and then, sit DeHarnay now and then. And see what the lineup looks like with him in it, because I think that the puck moving he provides is going to be solid for the Oilers. I like the deals that the Oilers made. What's your take?
Here's a number for you, David. 49. It's the number of games that Chris Knobloch has coached now with the same starting six defensemen, played every game. Broberg played a couple at the beginning, but he only played a handful of minutes as the seventh guy, and then they quickly sent him down to the minors where he's remained. And then Philip Kemp got one game where he was the only guy available to fill in for someone who was sick in Montreal. And he got three or four shifts playing forward. They wouldn't put him at his natural position and go with 7D in that scenario. And they just stuck with the six. So it's been the same six guys for months. And, you know, Edmonton's defensive record has gradually improved over much of that time with a little bit of up and down. And so obviously that's the default position of Chris Knobloch and Paul Coffey, is that these are our six guys. So I'll be very interested to see how they get Stetcher in there. I'm quite anxious to see him. He's kind of a little bit of left or right shot Brett Kulak. You know, his wheels are a real strength of his, and he's a gutsy player you know, he won't shy away from winning races to pucks because he's going to get hit, you know, that kind of thing. And that was pointed out by some people who knew him well, say that, you know, somebody said he's 5'9", standing on a phone book and plays like he's 7 feet. This was the Arizona commenter. So
we'll see.
And that was the team that traded him last year and then signed him back for this year and traded him again. Right. So
the most positive review of the Oilers' work came from Kevin Bieksa, which was actually really encouraging, Bruce, because Kevin Bieksa is really freaking smart. Like, he really is. I'm of all the hockey commentators out there, now that I don't hear Ferraro that much,
right?
I really put a lot of weight in what Bieksa says. He's a very, like, for instance, in breaking down the plays during the game, he's excellent at that. In saying what went wrong and who should have done what, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So here's what Bieksa had to say. Excuse me, just taking a second to find it on my post here on Sportsnet. What did the Oilers do? They beefed up. They picked up two forwards in Henrique and Carrick, who can play winger center, tons of depth, tons of leadership. Troy Stetcher for a little depth on defense. I like the Oilers, he said. And I also want to go back to what Bieksa said previously on deadline day as well, where he was talking about the hazards of adding players, like a lot of players at the deadline. And I thought actually this was a really apt comment as well. And he says, when you're a contending team and you add, it's sexy on paper, it's sexy on the show. But when you're a player in that dressing room and somebody new comes in, you're like, okay, whose spot is he going to be in? Whose power play spot? Whose penalty kill spot does he get? It doesn't always necessarily make your team better. And then some of the guys are like, we're a good team. We're LA and New York, and we're New York. We're in a playoff spot. We've done well all year. And how are you bringing in this guy to kind of take that job? Well, I think I'm doing a pretty good job at that job. You know what I mean? it's not always a positive thing in the locker room. So, and I know a lot of people scoffed at this, and it was mentioned a number of times by commentators about how Ken Holland didn't want to upset the chemistry in the dressing room of the Oilers with moves. But given the way human beings are, hockey players are human beings, you can see dissension being caused. You can see, you know, on the Oilers right now, for instance, Tetcher's here. He's going to get in the lineup, and automatically, who's ever sitting out is going to be judging very closely how Troy Stetcher does in the lineup. So, and Edmonton's a team that didn't make, you know, a ton of moves. And, you know, if Stetcher gets in the lineup, he's really going to have to earn it to stick there. You can be sure of that. So, if you're just looking at what Edmonton did, divorced from, you know, the moves other teams made, which right. were splashier, mm-hmm. looks like they did pretty well. I think they did okay.
Yeah, well, certainly Vegas was the splashiest, getting the great big guy from Washington Capitals there.
Mantha.
His name escapes me again. Anthony Mantha.
Yeah.
Number 39, who reminds me of Dustin Penner as much as anybody. He's a great big guy, kind of a gentle giant, very skilled.
Well, Dustin Penner was a good player.
Yeah, he was. He was. I had time for Dustin Penner, but they obviously made the big move getting Hanifin out of Calgary, and that'll shore up their defense. And Hurdle, well, he's hurt, and he's going to be hurt for a while. And he is a great big guy, not very fast. He's 30 years old, and he's got 6 more years to run on his contract. Big on faceoff, very good faceoff man. But he's been crushed defensively, at least these last 2 years. And, of course, the big asterisk there is he plays for San Jose Sharks. Everybody gets crushed defensively. But it'll be interesting to see how well he fits in and where they try and plug him in to make him fit. Like, if he's their 3C, well, my goodness, that's, you know, that's a load to be trying to deal with. I mean,
well, that's what he'll probably be, yeah.
I mean, 6'3", 215. And anyway, so they've added sort of high-profile players. And I would suggest all of those guys may be more high-profile than Adam Henrique. Well, Henrique is, you know, his goals and points record stands up to...
Better than Hurdle.
Hurdle and to Mantha.
Yeah.
And his versatility stands up as well, like his ability to play multiple positions. So he's kind of an underrated pickup. I mean, he's been lost in Anaheim, which is kind of like being lost in San Jose in terms of not being very high profile these days just because the team is not that good. As for Carrick, who went 8-0 in the faceoff circle today, 100%, he's just bottom line grit player, and whether he's better or worse than other guys down at the bottom of the roster, well, he's going to get a chance to show where he fits. But he does at least bring some bit of a physical element to the bottom six, which is missing on the Oilers. And then Stetcher is sort of the, in a sense, unknown in terms of how he will fit in within the unit, but a guy with pretty decent pedigree of, you know, 500 game career is not nothing, and he's still only 29 years old.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder if Winnipeg could have had Adam Henrique, because they took Monahan, and I wonder who made the better choice.
First for him.
First and a conditional third. I wonder who made the better choice, Winnipeg or Edmonton. That'll be an interesting comparison to see how it all plays out. Colorado made just a ton of moves. So, again, you know, obviously Bruce, Vegas stole the show and made some splashy moves. And Hanifin is really good at skating the puck out of the zone. And apparently, you know, from reading some Vegas commentators, the big problem in Vegas this year has been a kind of a lack of mobility on the defense. They have had trouble getting the puck out. They've had trouble moving the puck. And you know, it's an older group of defensemen now with Martinez and Peter Angelo and Braden McNabb. So Hanifin might really help them in an area of major weakness. So that's big for Vegas. And, you know, the Hurdle trade's an interesting one. The fact that he's there for a long time going forward, and he seems to be trending down a bit in his career, is hopeful news for Oilers fans. Yeah, exactly. Really, really good news.
Yeah.
We'll see.
He's on, though, he is an absolute load and difficult to contain.
He is. That's what I remember of him. He's a skilled,
and
tough
kid. It could well be that his escape from San Jose will catapult him to higher performance levels, you know.
Yeah.
Playing on a much better team with real prospects to go places.
It seems like people put a really high value on Vegas prospects, like Calgary with Daniil Miromanov and San Jose with David Edstrom, you know, who was 32nd pick in the draft.
He's Reed Schaefer. This trade was very similar to the Ekholm trade last year, where they traded their most recent first rounder, a future first rounder, which for them somehow is next year, and this year is like they managed to keep. And the thing that absolutely stunned me about this trade, which was misreported at first, there was 2 third rounders that changed hands, but they both went from San Jose to Vegas, and I just can't believe it. Like, what
was Mike Gerd? What is he thinking? What is he doing?
He's retaining, and always he's got all three of his retention spots now are locked up for another year because he's still paying retention on Brett Burns, who was sold at a discount with years left on his big money pact, and also on Eric Karlsson, who was sold with years remaining on his big money pact, and now on Thomas Hertl with many years remaining on his big money packs. Like, they sign these guys and say, well, they're not really worth it. Let's dump them and we'll even pay some of the freight just to get rid of them. Like, why are you signing players? What is the plan in San Jose? I don't understand. They're going to be rebuilding for years.
They seem to be in their Tambellini era.
Oh, that's harsh.
It's a fair comment.
Well, I will say this. I don't understand what is the objective. Were they trying to build around Thomas Hertl when they just signed him like a year or two ago to this long-term deal?
You know, and they moved Karlsson too late. They needed to move him at the trade deadline last year when he had the highest possible value.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, tearing up the NHL. Right. People in Edmonton were clamoring to trade Evan Bouchard for him. Mm-hmm. So, and my quote on it, because I looked it up after we talked about it last time, was it wouldn't be crazy if they did that. So even I was on board with it, I have to admit. Like, I wouldn't have complained at the time. So, to my shame. But I was less enthusiastic than some, I will say that. Some people were super enthusiastic, and I won't name them because that would be not nice.
It wasn't me, right?
I don't know, Bruce. I haven't checked. I didn't check your Twitter timeline to see.
Oh, Twitter time. Yeah, I suppose it would be in there.
I was just looking at articles published.
I was nervous about it, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I don't like trading young players for guys in their 30s. I'm just never much of a fan of that.
Yeah.
Oh, which reminds me, I misquoted Ted Green the other day when I talked about, I'm trying to remember which player it was. And it was some guy, was it Klima? It was some guy that looked good, and Ted Green's exact quote, now that I remember it, was some scouts and people look at this player, we'll call him Peter Kleba, and imagine the peak. I look at him and I see fog above the tree line. Which is a much more damning way of saying it than I put it the first time, in terms of what was going on in his head, basically. So the takeaway from that, and Green had some wonderful quotes.
Was it about Klima? Do you remember?
It was about, sure, yeah, now. No, it was about some young guy who, you know, had the whole world before him and didn't. I mean, Klima at least did got a lot done in his career, even as some expected him to be a long-term big star.
He certainly did.
So, but it was a guy who, you know, just sort of befuddled you. Like, you think there's more there. Where in the hell is it going to come out in the games? And it was a fellow like that. And sure. Anyway, the fog above the tree line was the money quote.
Very poetic. Very poetic.
Terrible Ted.
Well, Bruce, I think we've exhausted the topics that we were going to talk about today. Any final thoughts?
Game tomorrow. I got to write about that now. That wonderful display of hockey. And good thing it's early in the day, so get that done with and on to other more enjoyable stuff. So I think they're distracted by the trade deadline. I kind of hope they'd put it behind them today. And I sincerely hope that by tomorrow morning, they'll show up ready to deliver. And it will be their sixth game in 9 days. And that's presumably part of the doldrums that they're finding themselves in at the moment. But be better.
Bruce, thanks for talking today.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
And in the meantime,